Now it's my pleasure to welcome to you the session on immunizations, understanding the risks and benefits. This morning's session will be presented by Dr. E. Richard Steem. Dr. Steem is a professor of pediatrics in the Allergy, Immunology, and Rheumatology Division at the UCLA David Geffen School of Medicine in Los Angeles. So he is also a member of IDF's Medical Advisory Committee. So please join me in welcoming Dr. Steem.
Thank you. Thank you all for coming. Whenever you give a talk early in the morning, you're always concerned that nobody's going to show. And one time, I was asked to give a talk at Amarillo, Texas, 8 o'clock in the morning. There was only one person in the audience, and I waited a while, but then time passed, and so I gave my talk, and the one person in the audience clapped and asked a good question, which I answered. And then, as I was leaving, he was saying, "Where are you going?" And I said, "Well, I'm going back to Los Angeles. I gave my talk." He said, "You can't go. I'm the second speaker." So we're going to talk about a very important topic for immunodeficient patients, for contacts, which many of you are, and for yourself. And I'll start with a quotation. "The impact of vaccination on the health of the world's people would be hard to exaggerate. With the exception of safe water, no other modality, not even antibiotics, have had such a major effect on mortality reduction and population growth." That's from the textbook of vaccines. And to emphasize this, look at the mortality of these illnesses in the 20th century versus 2011, and so that many diseases, including smallpox, have been eradicated. Diphtheria has been eradicated. The one illness that's still around is pertussis, and we're going to have more to say about that. But many of you older people remember getting being quarantined for polio scare, and so vaccines are really important. And for example, measles now is making a comeback because there's a lot of people that don't feel that they should be vaccinated for measles. And part of the problem is that there's so many different vaccines now that are recommended for all children. You can see this chart, all the yellow is the time. So there's now 17 vaccines that are recommended for normal children. So I'm going to talk a little bit about new vaccines, reaching high immunization rates, and vaccine delivery. And I'm going to skip this. So one quote, my favorite quote, is one mother to another, "I would never give my child that dangerous influenza vaccine if he hadn't died of measles last summer." So there's types of immunity. There's natural immunity, the kind that we all have. You know, there's hundreds of diseases like dog distemper that you don't get because you don't have the reception. You have species natural immunity. Then there's active immunity. What happens when you get an illness or get a vaccine, you develop antibodies, and that lasts a long time. That's active immunity. And that's often for a lifetime, but often you have to get boosted. There's passive immunity, which many of you and your parents get, are giving gamma globulin, and they give you antibodies. The problem is antibodies only last for 2 or 3 weeks. And the thing that's important for all of you is herd immunity. So if 95% of the people in the community are vaccinated against something, then that disease is going to be eradicated, and so the disease cannot back. But when something below 95 occurs, then the disease can occur and you've lost this herd immunity. So the history of vaccines started all, many of you have probably heard this story, when William Jenner noted that the scourge of the 17th century smallpox, which wiped out the American Indians and everything, the only patients that didn't get it were women that milked cows. And the reason they didn't get it is because they got sores on their hands from dealing with cowpox, which is a variant of smallpox. It's called vaccinia. And if you get vaccinia, then you don't get smallpox. And so in the old days, what you did is give a vaccinia illness to a person by giving a vaccine, and that prevented smallpox, and that wiped out smallpox in the world. Pasteur, a century later, developed a vaccine for rabies, another fatal disease, but he didn't even know the virus was. He just ground up some material from a patient and gave it, and that seemed to do the trick. And then there's been a number of other vaccines since, we'll go through that. So this is a very famous picture of him immunizing this little boy, and then he was exposed to smallpox, which is very contagious, and lo and behold, he was protected. And so that's how vaccines started. Beforehand, the story is, they had something called variolation. Actually, smallpox, the name of the disease is variola, and George Washington and a number of our founding fathers actually would get variolation, and they took a person with smallpox, took a little bit of their sores, and gave it to themselves. They had a mild case of smallpox, and they were protected. And so that's called variolation. So that's the precursor of vaccination. This is what smallpox looks like. It doesn't look small to me, but that's what it was called, because syphilis, the sores are even bigger. That was large pox. And so this is what smallpox looks like. Well, my introduction to vaccines was in 1948. It was hot. I was grounded, no movies, no swimming, no trips to the store, no summer camp. I didn't even do anything bad. My mother was a nurse, silenced my complaints. Do you want to spend the rest of your life in an iron lung? I was allowed to go down just once to the health department for a gamma globulin shot. I didn't get polio, thanks in part to this injection, and that was gamma globulin. That prevented polio, but just for a couple of months. And then the scourge was over when Salk came along and invented his vaccine, and no longer a scare. Actually, my wife spent her kindergarten year in a body cast because she did get polio. So this was a thing that we all saw pictures of, iron lung, where your head protruded from this area, and a big baffle helps you breathe back and forth. So it's not a good thing to have, is iron lung. And so any hospital, like a Boston Children's Hospital or the hospital where I was taken care of, in the warehouse, they still have these iron lungs, which are just kind of historical. So why do we need to use current vaccines? Well, 10% of U.S. kids enter school unimmunized. 55% of children unimmunized against influenza, and there are 131 deaths from flu. 55% of the girls between 13 and 17 do not get the HPV vaccine. As you know, that prevents cervical cancer, and so it's a killed, inactivated vaccine, and it's a very good one. A recent measles outbreak in Indiana killed 38 people, and pertussis is now coming back. So some general considerations. We're talking about serious allergic reactions, serious acute diseases, progressive neurologic diseases, some recommended for pregnancy and young age, and in primary or secondary immunodeficiency, which is what we're going to emphasize today, and how gamma globulin may interfere with immunizations. So newborns, when you're first born, you get a hepatitis vaccine, hepatitis B vaccine, and then the next vaccine you get is oral rotavirus vaccine. Rotavirus causes a diarrhea disease. It's of interest that rotavirus is given before children with severe combined immunodeficiency get sick, and there's been a number of serious illnesses with rotavirus vaccine in patients with severe combined immunodeficiency. The main vaccine that most of you have had is diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. Diphtheria and tetanus are not much of a problem, but pertussis, as we'll talk about later, is a serious problem. Haemophilus influenza causes a respiratory disease and a big cause of pneumonia and meningitis. That's given four times in the first year of life, and then, as is the pneumococcal polysaccharide or conjugate vaccine called Prevnar. So, and then polio virus inactivated. The Salk vaccine is given in the first year of life, and seasonal influenza. So that poor little baby is going to get a lot of shots in the first year, and it's expensive, but it's worthwhile. For vaccines at 1 to 7 is the measles, mumps, and rubella, and varicella. These are live virus vaccines. And the reason that they're delayed is because the mother's maternal antibody may prevent a good take from them if they're given before a year of life. Hepatitis A is recommended after 12 months and an annual flu shot, and then the boosters for the other vaccines, hepatitis B, pneumococcus, DPT, and haemophilus. Then from 7 to 18, you get a booster, but now they give a lower dose for diphtheria and pertussis because they're more reactive. The new thing is the meningitis vaccine. You've probably heard that there was an epidemic of meningitis in UC Santa Barbara and Princeton, I think. And so that there was an old vaccine that included four strains of meningitis, but not type B, and that was the one that caused an epidemic. Well, just in the newspaper, I just read that they now are recommending that if you've got school-age kids entering college, that that's a recommended vaccine now to prevent meningococcal B. Boys and girls now are recommended for the papillomavirus vaccine, which is it's a non-live vaccine, and it is very effective in preventing cervical cancer, annual flu vaccine, and boosters for incomplete. Now, in our age, yearly influenza vaccine, Tdap, which is tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, and used in adults every 10 years, and very important in pregnant women. We'll go into that in a bit. Meningococcal vaccine for college-age kids, and completing the other ones. If you're over 60, you recommend it to have an influenza vaccine, and now they recommended that all patients get the childhood Prevnar vaccines for pneumococcus and also the booster, which is, contains 23. And we'll go into meningococcal pneumococcal vaccines in a minute. And then keeping your DTaP. It used to be that children gave pertussis to their older people. Now it's just the reverse. It's adults with cough disease have pertussis, and they expose their babies and their children to it. And then everyone over 60 should get a shingles vaccine. A shingles vaccine is exactly the same as the varicella vaccine, but the dose is 14 times higher. And because shingles is going to occur in about 50% of people over 60 without this vaccine. So that it's a very important vaccine. So that you can see that's the lineup of vaccines. So now let's talk about what's really important to this group, vaccines in immunodeficiency and their family members. Well, patients that have a severe antibody deficiency, these are patients with X-linked agammaglobulinemia, common variable immunodeficiency, hyper-IgM syndrome. They should never get live virus vaccines. That includes measles, mumps, rubella, varicella, rotavirus, BCG, which we don't give in this country, which is a tuberculosis vaccine, and a type of influenza vaccine that's blown up into your nose, that's called FluMist, which is a very good vaccine, but it's a live virus vaccine, so not, should not be used. It's really an interesting vaccine because it's cold adapted. It grows in the nose, but then if it goes into the chest, it gets inactivated, so it won't cause pneumonia. Patients with antibody deficiency on gamma globulin usually have antibody to most of these illnesses, so you don't need the vaccine. But the one exception is influenza, because influenza changes every year, so gamma globulin, which is derived from antibodies from everyone else, doesn't have antibody to influenza. So even though you have no response to the vaccine, it may stimulate your cellular immunity, and so if you do get exposed to influenza, you might get over it faster. So they recommend an inactivated vaccine for patients with severe antibody deficiency. Now, if you have a less severe antibody deficiency, and these include selective IgA deficiency, patients with subclass deficiency, or patients with selective antibody deficiency where you respond to proteins okay, but you don't respond to polysaccharides, there was a session on that. It's recommended that all you can get most of the vaccines. They're usually quite safe. If you're getting IVIG, most of these vaccines won't work, and the exception, as I said, is influenza. Now, what if you have a cellular immunodeficiency where there's something wrong with your T cells, often in combined with an antibody defect? This would be patients with severe combined immunodeficiency, the complete DeGeorge syndrome or Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome patients that often are candidates for transplants, should not get any live virus vaccines, and the inactivated vaccines probably are not going to work. The patients with a touch of immunodeficiency, partial combined immunodeficiency, like most DeGeorge patients, killed vaccines are okay. And a good rule is if your T cells are greater than 300, you can go ahead and get the vaccine. But BCG and vaccinia are not recommended. Okay, what if you have a phagocytic or complement defects? This is illnesses called chronic granulomatous disease, or having a complement defect, which are pretty rare diseases. Most of them have a normal immunologic response to antibodies, and so they do respond to vaccines, but they probably should not get a BCG vaccine or vaccinia. In the rotavirus vaccine, most of these people won't be diagnosed in the first year of life. So what about family members of patients that have immunodeficiency? You should keep your vaccines up to date, including MMR and varicella vaccines. You should not get rotavirus. You should not get the rotavirus. You have a baby in the family. There's a possibility that the rotavirus vaccine could get into the immunodeficient patient. You should not get BCG, which is usually not a problem. And you should not get an activated, not get the nasal flu vaccine. You can get an inactivated influenza vaccine. But it's particularly important that you have your flu vaccine updated, that you get pertussis vaccine, the DTaP, and pneumococcal vaccine, and the shingles vaccine, because you're exposed to these people. The patients with immunodeficiency are exposed, so it's really important that family members get their vaccine. Now, if you're over 60, you should get your annual influenza vaccine, and nowadays they recommend pneumococcal vaccine, Prevnar vaccine, which is a protein vaccine, and so all people over 60 now, it's recommended that they get that, as well as the zoster vaccine. Yeah. Herpes zoster, as you know, is caused by the same virus that causes chickenpox. It stays in the nerve root. Once you get a herpes vaccine, herpes illness, it's there for the rest of your life. And it reappears as you get older as shingles, which are located at the very pain. Any of you have had shingles? Not fun, huh? Did you have the vaccine?
No.
No, okay. So it's of interest that the shingles vaccine is not recommended for immunodeficiency, but the people that are likely to get shingles are people with a partial immunodeficiency, so it's a catch-22. However, in the New England Journal of Medicine just a month ago, there was an article about a new recombinant shingles vaccine that is dead, that won't cause disease, that will be a great help. And that's particularly important for cancer patients because they're very susceptible for getting severe herpes and shingles. And so this vaccine may well boost them and prevent shingles in these patients. So the vaccine is called Zostrifax, and it's just the same as the vaccine for chickenpox. So to prevent chickenpox, you need to have antibody, and that will be stimulated by the chickenpox vaccine. But to prevent shingles, you need cellular immunity. That's why you need a much bigger dose of that. The contraindications for the shingles vaccine are immunosuppression and primary immunodeficiency and pregnancy. So let's talk a little bit about some specific diseases that are vaccine preventable. The rotavirus vaccine is the most common cause of non-bloody diarrhea with fever and vomiting in infants. And in the world, it's one of the leading causes of death of children. So that there's now two oral vaccines that are given between 2 months and 6 months. They're called Rotatec or Rotarix. And as I said, that they are of risk to patients with severe combined immunodeficiency. And as you might have heard, there's a new program now for identifying patients with severe combined immunodeficiency by doing cord blood testing, newborn screening, and one of the benefits of that is that these children that have severe combined immunodeficiency don't get the rotavirus vaccine. So this is a live virus vaccine. The contraindications are immunodeficiency, acute illness, intestinal tract disease, or severe combined immunodeficiency. And there was an earlier rotavirus vaccine which caused a gastrointestinal problem called intussusception, but the new vaccines don't have that problem. So rotavirus vaccines from 2 months to 6 months. Okay, polio vaccine. As you know, there's two vaccines, the Salk, who discovered an inactivated polio virus vaccine, and then for a while, they switched over to the Sabin vaccine, which is a live attenuated vaccine. The problem with that is that a few patients that got the live virus vaccine got paralytic polio. One of the things that has happened with polio, it goes into the central nervous system and causes a severe illness. I just had a patient that was a 13-month-old boy, comes in with hemiparesis, like he's had a stroke. And they thought that he had multiple sclerosis, which can appear in an infant. So they did a spinal tap, and one of the diagnostic tests for multiple sclerosis, they have a high gamma globulin spike in their their spinal fluid. Well, this boy had none. He didn't have a spike at all. He didn't even have any. So we sent him to the immunologist. We did a study on him, and he had no gamma globulin whatsoever. From the spinal fluid, we grew out the live virus polio vaccine, and he's paralyzed for life. Now, if you happen to have, if you're injured by a childhood vaccine, there's a compensation program the government will pay you to because of your, and this child did actually get $250,000, but it's nothing compared to his medical expenses. So the oral polio vaccine is used around the world. The advantage of the oral polio vaccine is you excrete it, and people that are not immunized will get the disease, and get the vaccine, and they'll get it. So it gets you much better herd immunity. So most of the places in the world still use the oral polio vaccine. In our country, we go back to the Salk vaccine, where you get multiple injections. So as I said, the government has a vaccine compensation program. If a child has been injured by a childhood vaccine, the government will pay you. And you're paying for it because there's a surcharge of 75 cents on every vaccine that's given, and that supports this particular program. Pertussis, whooping cough, is making a comeback. It's a person with a cough has a characteristic severe cough. It goes on and on and on. Babies whoop. After they cough, they make this terrible whooping noise, but adults don't have that. But it's coming back. It's a really a mini epidemic since 2005. And the reason why, in the old days, you remember the old DTP vaccine caused seizures and sometimes high fevers. It was very, very common. So they changed the vaccine. They made it much milder, and it's called acellular pertussis vaccine. The problem is it doesn't work very well. It only lasts for 3 years, and that's why it's important to get the people vaccinated and continue them. So they tried to do the right thing by making the vaccine weaker, but it doesn't last as long. And so many, many people, particularly in upper-class neighborhoods, don't want their kids immunized, and so that they don't get the pertussis vaccine, and so that's why it comes back. So one of the big areas that's really severe is infants between 0 and 2 months of age getting pertussis. It can be a very fatal disease. And so it's recommended that all pregnant women get the pertussis vaccine, even if they had a pertussis vaccine in the just recent future, because, as I said, the vaccine doesn't last long. So a pregnant woman should get pertussis vaccine to protect her baby, and any adult that takes care of this newborn baby should be have the pertussis vaccine also. So they're working to develop a better vaccine, and you can see the incidence of pertussis is increasing every single year, and it's really a mini epidemic in many areas of the country, including my own, which happens to be in West Los Angeles, where a lot of Hollywood folks don't believe in vaccines. So the standard vaccine for children is tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, high dose, and they get 5 times in the 7 years of life, and then boosters every 10 years. And the vaccine for adults is called low-dose diphtheria and altered pertussis. And so adolescents and adults should get that. So then we come to influenza vaccines. There are many, there's 6 or 7 different kinds of parental vaccines. There's 2 kinds of influenza, A and B. And so the inactivated usual kind of vaccines is the trivalent or the quadrivalent inactivated vaccine that's given yearly. However, for people over 65, there's a high dose that is more effective, so that they should get that. And a Fluzone is given intradermally. And then there's a new vaccine that it just is a jet stream. You get it through a jet stream, so there's no injection. And then there's 2 flu vaccines for people that are egg sensitive, because this virus is grown on eggs. And indeed, as you heard, that there was a big chicken illness, and so they're worried that there's not enough eggs to make the vaccine. And then there's this cold adapted flu mist vaccine that's given intranasally. The pneumococcal vaccine I want to say a word about. There's 2 kinds of pneumococcal vaccines. One is called PCV, Prevnar 13, containing 13 different strains of pneumococcus. And then there's another one, a polysaccharide vaccine that contains 23 strains. There's 100 different strains of pneumococcus, so you can get this disease over and over again. But the PCV 13 is the most common strains of pneumococcal disease, and the polysaccharide contains all of those strains plus 10 additional ones. And so that there's an illness. How many went to the selective antibody deficiency? So you did. You know that this vaccine, particularly the pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine, can be used to test for patients that make antibodies to proteins, but they don't make antibodies to polysaccharides. And so that they tend to get respiratory infections over and over again. So that the way to test for that is to give a child or an adult this vaccine, the polysaccharide vaccine called Pneumovax, and then check the titers. And there's a certain number of responses that you should get. So that it's very valuable to the immunologist to identify. For children, they start using the Prevnar at 2 to 12 months of age, and then a fifth dose in 13 to 24. And then if you've been previously unimmunized, you get two vaccines of the Prevnar. A very good vaccine, but it doesn't cover all the strains. It covers 13 of them. And so they now give the pneumococcal polysaccharide to high-risk patients. For adults, high-risk patients should get the pneumococcal polysaccharide vaccine and the Prevnar vaccine. And as I mentioned, it's used for diagnosis of selective antibody deficiency. Let's talk a little bit more about influenza. Incubation period of 1 to 4 days, febrile illness, myalgia, headaches, cough, seasonal epidemics, pandemics, serious in infants and aged. These are the two groups that die from influenza. As you know, the Spanish flu during the First World War killed 10 times more people than was killed in the battlefield. It just wiped out people like mad. And there's three main types, A, B, and C. A and B are the ones that cause trouble. And as I mentioned, the Spanish flu killed 5% of the world's population, 100 million people. The bird flu has affected 40 million birds. There's been an egg shortage now. The price of eggs is going up. And the flu vaccine, and so that there may be a shortage of that particular kind of flu. One of the things that's a new thing, that's fairly new, is that when you get influenza, there are antiviral agents that are quite good against it. And so, especially an immunodeficient patient, if he has a suggestion of getting flu, should go on these antivirals, Tamiflu. So nearly everybody should get the influenza vaccine. I mentioned the meningococcal vaccine. Meningococcal meningitis is a really dreadful disease, a 25% mortality. And there's usually epidemics among crowded teenagers, so like college students or military recruits. And for certain immunodeficiency, if you have a complement deficiency, you're susceptible to this. And this is a big killer. And so there is a killed conjugate vaccine called Menactra that's given for high-risk children, which would be immunodeficient patients. And there's a new vaccine for hepatitis for meningococcal type B. So any patient that has a really high fever, you have to worry about this condition. I think we covered that. Okay. Human papillomavirus, I mentioned a little bit about that, causes cervical cancer, anogenital and respiratory wart infection, is sexually transmitted, and 40% of adults are infected with papillomavirus. The vaccine is a non-infectious recombinant vaccine called Gardasil for females aged 9 to 26. You should start using it before you get sexually active. three vaccines, and boys are now recommended to get this also. It reduces the cervical cancer fold eightfold, prevents genital wart. Other strains may proliferate. It's very controversial. Some people think it makes girls more sexually active. The just recent paper says it's not so, and now they all recommend it for males. So what about some concerns of vaccines? Well, long-term concerns like mercury or the vaccines cause autism. That's been disproved. In fact, the person that said that from England had the paper refuted, and it was complete medical nonsense. Medical vaccines overwhelm the immune system. Well, pertussis illness contains 3,000 different antigens, and all of the flu and all of these vaccines put together are only 300. So getting a natural illness is much more challenging to the immune system. So the immune system can handle all kinds of things. So multiple vaccines don't overwhelm the immune system. Vaccines are not necessary because these diseases are rare. Remember, we're trying to get 95% of the people vaccinated so you get herd immunity. Vaccines promote allergy. You know, one of the thoughts why allergy is increasing because you live in such a clean environment. And there's a recent paper, you might have heard about it, that the old days, they said, if you don't want to get peanut allergy, just avoid peanuts for the first 2 years. Now the thought is you should get peanuts early in life, and then you become tolerant to them. And it's known, for example, that kids that live in a farmland have a less serious incidence of asthma because they're exposed to lots of antigens that people living in upper middle class existence don't do. And indeed, they did this in East Germany, which is a rural area, and they had a very low incidence of asthma compared to West Germany. And then since the countries reunited, East Germany is becoming much more urban, and higher standard of evidence, the incidence of asthma is going up. So it's likely that getting people completely immunized might increase the incidence of allergy. Costly, discomfort, multiple doctor visits, yes, that's the price we're going to pay for that. So in summary, vaccines have saved more lives than any other health intervention except for a clean water supply. 16 recommended vaccines from birth to 18 years. 3 vaccines for people over 60 include shingles, the Pneumovax, and the adult pertussis vaccine. For immunodeficient children, most killed vaccines are okay but may not respond. Live viruses are contraindicated. Rotavirus, measles, mumps, rubella, vaccinia, flu mist, and BCG. And family members, contacts should keep vaccines up to date. Patients on IVIG usually don't need or respond to vaccines. The exception I said is influenza. So in summary, bring you up to date on a crime that's happened. A thief stole 8 paintings from the Louvre. After careful planning, he avoids security, steals the paintings, and makes it safely to his van. However, he was captured 2 blocks away when his van ran out of gas. When the cop asked him, "How could you mastermind such an amazing crime and then make sure and make such an obvious error?" he replied, "Mansoor, that is the reason I stole the paintings, because I had no Monet to buy the gas, to make the Van Gogh. I figure I had nothing to loot." Do you have the gall to tell this to somebody else? That's it. Thank you.